Ms. Rowe, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good afternoon, and may it please the court. The amicus amici curiae in this case, the Insurance Council of New Jersey and the New Jersey Civil Justice Institute, offer the perspective of the insurance industry and the business community in this matter. In short, those who seek to enforce the contractual benefits that have already been negotiated in the terms of the per the terms that have already been negotiated by those involved with the contract and stand in the shoes of those persons should also have to take the sort of things in the contract that they don't necessarily agree with or want to comply with. Here, there's a valid arbitration provision that should be enforced, and New Jersey's insurance industry and business community depend on the efficiency, predictability of entering into arbitration agreements, and specifically in commercial disputes. It's important for New Jersey economy that these arbitration provisions, where they're valid and there's a reason to enforce them, should continue to be enforced so that these touchstones can be honored. The appellate division's ruling does violate the Federal Arbitration Act and the New Jersey Arbitration Act, as both of these laws have provisions that state that you can't disfavor an arbitration agreement for any reasons that exceed traditional state law or state equity principles. So it seems here that there are two ways that we can reach that result. As Justice Albin observed, there is a statutory basis for referring back to the valid arbitration agreement that was once entered into by both Kinsale and the original defendants. And as Justice Patterson noted, there would be other reasons for enforcing the arbitration agreement. And there was discussion amongst the justices and Mr. Mahoney about the principles of equitable estoppel, which here would serve as a shield to protect the integrity of the valid arbitration agreement here. There's the direct benefits theory of equitable estoppel, which seems to be a good way of articulating the interests and equities at stake here. You have Kinsale Insurance Company, who is participating in this litigation. And then you have Mr. Sawyer's clients, the Condo Association, who seeks to stand directly in the shoes of the original insureds. This stands in contrast with other cases where equitable estoppel in the Third Circuit and in our state courts wasn't applied because there was some differences in the claims, but here, by virtue of it being a direct action, they directly stand in the shoes of the coverage claims that the insureds would have had sought if they were not insolvent and not participating in this litigation. In Hodgnowski versus Van Skate Park, 187 New Jersey 323, 2006, there seems to be some receptiveness from this court to engage in this direct benefits theory of equitable estoppel. And that would be an appropriate basis in this case for enforcing the arbitration agreement as the original parties originally contracted to, and had the original defendants remained solvent, would have expected to be enforced down the road. There's also a longstanding public policy in favor of arbitration in New Jersey that dates back even to the—
Ms. Rowe, before you go on to your next point, are you focusing on the equitable estoppel argument and other potential equitable arguments based on the idea that we may not find the statute to apply? Because it seems to me that if the statute applies, there's a very simple argument for arbitration that would not involve any equitable doctrines.
That's correct. And as amici curiae, our focus here is truly more of the broader principles that, even ignoring sort of the specificity of the direct action statute, and we join Mr. Mahoney's arguments that it doesn't apply, but more broadly, we're interested in making sure that equitable estoppel remains vibrant in New Jersey and remains a method of protecting validly entered into and enforceable arbitration clauses.
Understood. And I understand your perspective from a broader reach here, but you do agree with the position taken by Kinsale, do you not, that on the direct action statute alone, with the language that's been cited, the entire contract is applied, including the arbitration provision.
Yes, okay. That alone.
As I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate your candor. You're very helpful as an amicus, and you have been on prior occasions. You're saying for other members of your of the two organizations that you represent who may not have anything to do with the direct action statute, you would like to see reinforced the equitable provisions that might have a broader reach than the direct action statute.
That's correct, Justice Patterson.
But going off of what just Patterson just said, even if the statute doesn't apply and the common law applies, our common law third beneficiary jurisprudence says you stand in the shoes of the insured if you are bringing an action. And when you're standing in the shoes of the insured, that's you have to accept what the insured would have been bound to.
That's correct. That's correct. You don't get a better contract by virtue of any other situation.
So between the statutory and the common law, you don't even have to reach your public policy because it seems the statute and the common law already embrace it. Am I mistaken?
No, Your Honor, you're not mistaken. I just would like to bring the perspective of the insurance company and the insurance companies and the business community into this because arbitration agreements are so common in commercial contracts and then later on in commercial disputes. It's important that we keep all aspects of arbitration law vibrant and thriving, including, you know, sort of to these backstop equitable principles that we have the common law, we have these principles of perhaps the direct action statute applying here, but also that there's shields at equity too that would stand for enforcing arbitration agreements, not to mention the public policy benefits. There's quite a number of reasons for having arbitration agreements in commercial contracts. For example, they're more cost efficient. Litigation costs are added into the cost of premiums in New Jersey and indeed across the insurance industry. And the last thing the New Jersey economy needs is higher insurance premiums. So in mitigating litigation costs by turning as many commercial disputes as possible to arbitration, it will result in lower premiums for New Jersey businesses, customers, anybody who uses insurance in this state. Another benefit is a faster resolution for the parties. This is an obvious benefit, including for plaintiffs such as the condo association in this case, that especially in construction defect cases, these can be protracted lawsuits. But if you turn many commercial disputes to arbitration, we avoid that sort of protracted litigation. And finally, and perhaps most interestingly to specialized industries like the insurance industry, there's customizability in arbitration. You can have people who are industry experts serve as arbitrators, and you wouldn't be starting from ground zero as you might in other forums. In short, arbitration agreements in commercial disputes are important to the predictability, fairness, and efficiency of litigation in New Jersey, especially in commercial disputes. And these are the ingredients to a vibrant economy and serve to make it easier to do business in New Jersey. If your honors don't have any other questions, I'll close with that. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Ross.
I'm sorry, Chief. May I ask one question?
Go ahead.
The fact that this policy is a professional liability policy, both involving an engineer, inspector, and a construction contractor. Does that make a difference in terms of how we should view this particular arbitration provision, the enforcement of this particular arbitration provision?
It certainly weighs in favor of enforcing the arbitration provision because you have two sophisticated parties who regularly involve themselves in contracts that have arbitration agreements, more complex and more complex contracts to begin with. They negotiated for it. There was mutual assent. And now simply because of their status of insolvency, there's now Crystal Point coming in to stand directly in their shoes. This isn't, you know, sort of regular person versus regular person. These are professionals. These are sophisticated parties who agreed to this.
Thank you, Ms. Rao.
Thank you.
Mr. Sawyer.
Thank you, Your Honors, for the opportunity to be heard. And if it pleases the court, I will structure my comments the same way Mr. Mahoney did. I'll start with the applicability of the direct action statute and then move to the question of the enforceability of this arbitration provision. First, I'll quickly point out, as I did to the appellate division, that the argument that the direct action statute doesn't apply to this case and is limited to employee injuries, dog bites, and auto cases was not raised at the trial level. It was not raised until the defendant's opposition brief on the appeal. So I objected then, I'll object again now for the record. But putting that aside, Justice Radner, you took away my first argument, which was based on that first sentence of the statute itself. This was a statute that I believe has been on the books for almost 100 years, coming up on 100 years. And that first sentence refers to injury to employees or other persons. It does not say personal injury. It does not say bodily injury. It does not say any of the things that counsel for Kinzel is trying to write into the statute. It is not that restrictive. So that language is written broadly enough to apply to a person whose property has been damaged or injured. And therefore, the statute clearly does apply. I also agree with the two appellate division decision comments, both the one below in this case and the one in the Ferguson matter, that the statute is not restrictive in terms of what types of cases can be brought as direct claims. I'd also like to point out that the language that the direct action statute requires is in this policy. Kinzel's policy, which is attached to my client's complaint, has the language in it that this statute requires. And this is an architectural and professional liability statute. So I'd like the court to consider that when you're considering counsel's argument that this statute doesn't apply to an architectural professional liability claim. If that were true, why did they comply with the statute and put that language in? I would point out. The statute clearly applies. And more importantly, something I'm very concerned that I heard here is that, and I believe this was just Justice Patterson's comments, that the statute is superfluous. That is not true. The common law in New Jersey is very clear and has been very clear that an injured party has no rights to an insurance policy. And I would cite you to your decision in the matter of Ross versus Lowitz, L-O-W-I-T-Z, 222 NJ494 at page 512. And the quote, which is quoted commonly in my business, a stranger to an insurance policy has no right to recover the policy proceeds. The common law has been very clear in New Jersey that an injured party, prior to obtaining a judgment, has no rights to a policy. They are, at best, an incidental beneficiary. This was recognized by the trial court in its ruling on the original motion. So prior to obtaining a judgment, my client had no rights to this policy. And the insurance carrier, and all carriers, frankly, are very adamant about that. When you try to name them in a case that's pending on liability, they will move to dismiss every time, citing this case and others like it. You have no right against us until you get that judgment. What's further is that the only direct claim against the carrier that can be made by an injured party is when they've obtained that judgment following trial or, as counsel pointed out, perhaps some agreement with the insured, and they can show that it's uncollectible from the insured. Or under the Griggs versus Bertram matter, that there was an agreement because the carrier refused to defend and indemnify its insured, and an agreement was made between the insured and the plaintiff that you can proceed against my insurance. That's very clear. So without the direct action statute, injured parties would never be able to collect against Kinzel's policy or any other policy in New Jersey. I want to make sure we all understand that. That is the law. If this court were to find that the direct action statute was superfluous and unnecessary, injured parties would never be able to pursue insurance companies to collect, even if the insured was insolvent. So,
is that the case with the default judgment in place? Because that's what we're dealing with here. We're talking about a default judgment.
Yes, because let's make sure we're all clear about what happened here. This was litigation that lasted 4+ years. Kinzel's insureds were two of the defendants. Kinzel refused to defend and obviously indemnify either one of them. So my client went through 4+ years of litigation, went to trial against one of the parties, settled finally the entire thing halfway through the trial, and then had a default judgment hearing before, in my memory.
I understand you have a default judgment against both of them. My point is, does that put you under the common law? Does that give you rights as a third party beneficiary?
Not without the direct action statute. And I challenge this carrier or any other to represent to this court that they would recognize otherwise.
Okay.
And I know that's a broad statement and no one here can answer other than Mr. Mahoney, but that without that direct action statute, been on the books for 100 years, Your Honor made a point, we haven't heard anything about
it. Well, Mr. Mahoney has 2 minutes of rebuttal, so perhaps he'll take up your...
I look forward to hearing it because that's the reality.
What is the nature of the coverage argument that is being made as to each of the two insureds? I'm talking about not the issue of arbitrability, not direct action as to access to the policy, but the actual coverage argument that's being made. And I'm not asking you to argue because it's not before the court. Just want to understand what's the nature of the argument.
Very briefly, and Mr. Mahoney can correct me when he gets his opportunity, but I believe there are two insureds. As to the first one, Macamuli, there's an issue as to whether or not they are the actual entity that was insured. And then there's a question of the timing of when they submitted the claim. This is a claims made policy and you're required to submit the claim during the policy term. That's an issue as to Nakamuli, as to Hawk. Frankly, there was never a disclaimer of coverage as to Hawk, so I can't speak to what their position is there, but I'm presuming it's similar to their position on Nakamuli.
And your understanding of your adversary's argument is that if they were to prevail on their arbitration argument, then those issues, the ones you mentioned as Nakamuli and whatever coverage issues there may be, maybe along the same lines as to Hawk, would be submitted to the arbitrator. That's their argument. I'm not suggesting that you agree with that, but that's their argument.
They're arguing any dispute over coverage, which is what their arbitration provision says, goes to arbitration. And there's been a lot said as to why my clients shouldn't just accept it. It sounds so great. I'm not going to waste your time. I can tell you we don't want it.
Let's say you have the statute. So let's look at the language of the statute that seems to really hinge on whether or not this arbitration agreement should be enforceable. So I'll just read from it. I know that you are familiar with it.
Please.
Then an action may be maintained by the injured person or his personal representative against the corporation under the terms of the policy for the amount of the judgment, .. under the terms of the policy. So the question to you, you've heard all the questions going around, is why isn't the arbitration agreement one of the terms of the policy?
The way you read, I would read it slightly differently, Justice.
Okay.
Than the way you read it. Not the words.
I just read the words.
I understand. I understand. I would read the exact same words, but I'd read them with a little bit different inflection.
Okay, do that. Give us your histrionic interpretation of the words.
Go ahead. I read, it says an action may be maintained by the injured person or his representative against the corporation under the terms of the policy for the amount of the judgment in the action, not exceeding the amount of the policy.
Okay. And so you view that under the terms of the policy to only be about the amount of the judgment.
No, well, whether or not the amount of the judgment is covered by the language, the coverage language of the policy.
Do you have any legal support interpreting a similar policy in the way you were telling us to interpret it?
No, this is an issue of first impression for your honors. That much is clear.
So look, this is under the terms of the policy. Whether there is an arbitration agreement or not, the first thing that would have to be decided is whether there's coverage. Do you agree? Under the terms of the policy. Do the Correct. Terms of the policy apply?
Correct.
Yes? Okay. Yes. So that has something to do other than with the judgment. So if the terms of the policy have to be interpreted to see whether there's coverage, why would that rule out arbitration as one of the terms? I'm trying to figure that out.
Because the provision on arbitration is procedural. It has nothing to do with what amount of the judgment is or is not covered by.
The language goes to policy limits only? Is that what you're suggesting to the court? That language that you read deals with the policy limits only and nothing else?
No. The question in this, the coverage issues are whether or not the damages caused by the conduct of the insured are covered up to the limits of the policy. So there are exclusions, for example, that counsel referenced. Does an exclusion apply?
So how do you limit what you read to only the coverage then, the policy limits?
The language says, under the terms of the policy, let me make sure I'm quoting it correctly, may be maintained by the injured person against the corporation under the terms of the policy for the amount of the judgment. Whether you're in court or arbitration is a procedural.
You are limited to policy limits then, because the next sentence is not exceeding the amount of the policy. So you need to deal only with policy limits, no other terms in a policy, no other clauses, simply the policy limits section.
No, I understand what you're saying. I'm not arguing that I'm entitled to more than policy limits. You're always going to be subject to policy limits. What I'm saying is the phrase under the terms of the policy for the judgment up to the policy limit means that the issues are not just, we're not just going to go in there and say the policy limits X, I'm entitled to all of it. There are arguments as to whether or not the liability, the damages are the type that are covered by the policy that are not excluded. So the
let me ask it another way, Mr. Sawyer. Is other than the arbitration clause, please tell us what aspect of this insurance contract is not included in the language of the direct action statute. You see what I'm saying? Because I think you're saying the policy limits all the provisions as to dates and times and entities that might be litigated. That's all covered in that language of the direct action statute. And if you look through the policy, there really is only one provision, it seems to me, that you're saying suddenly gets plucked out of this, and that's the arbitration clause. Now tell me if I'm wrong. Tell me what else in that policy is excluded from the language of the statute.
Well, if you'd like me to go through it page by page, Judge, I will do that.
No, I'm not suggesting that. We don't want, in the interest of time, I'm not suggesting that. Just in global terms, you know this policy. You've been litigating it, as you pointed out, for 4.5 years. What are you trying to say is not within the direct action statute other than the arbitration clause?
There are entire sections in that policy between Kinsale and the insurer that discuss the defense and terms of settlement that are irrelevant because they refuse to defend and be participated in the case. There are issues in there.
I understand they're irrelevant, but are they excluded from the language of the direct action statute?
Yes, because they're not related to whether or not the judgment is covered by the policy.
So again, you limit that language to policy limits only, whether the judgment is covered by the terms of the limits of the policy.
Yes, okay.
That entire section, going back to my first question, you in fact agree that you limit that, you and your interpretation limit that to policy limits arguments only.
And whether or not the judgment is covered under those policy limits, yes.
Isn't that what I said, just different words?
Yes. Yes, Justice.
So as a third-party beneficiary, you get to pull out the what helps your client, and what you say, some parties may feel differently about arbitration, but you say you don't want arbitration, that doesn't help.
With all due respect, Judge, I don't agree that I'm a third-party beneficiary. That's the part I don't agree with in your statement. I am not a third-party beneficiary during the life of my underlying case. This court has made that clear. I'm only akin to a third-party beneficiary because of that statute. And that's what the Appellate Division recognized.
As a default judgment creditor, which you now are, right?
I have a judgment, correct.
Okay.
All right.
And so you are akin. So when you say you're akin to a third-party beneficiary, what does that mean?
That means that a third-party beneficiary is someone who was intended to benefit from the terms of the contract. That's the general definition in our law. Okay. I'm not a signatory to that contract. We all know that. There's no expressed intent in that policy to benefit me. There's case law that specifically says an injured party is not a third-party beneficiary. At best, they're an incidental beneficiary.
Okay.
So you heard the Chief Justice refer to Byrd. And Byrd refers to the statute. And Byrd says a claimant's interest is derivative of the insured's. I'm quoting. What do you think? Right? You agree with that?
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay, a claimant's interest is derivative of the insured's. So if it's derivative of the insured's, why should you have greater rights than the insured? Why aren't your rights equivalent to those of the insured? And if the insured was bound by an arbitration agreement, why aren't you?
Because my claim is for the money, the proceeds. That's what the direct action statute gives me the right to go after.
But the proceeds don't exist, counsel, unless the insurance policy exists. And the insurance policy doesn't exist unless the insured assented to the arbitration clause, which is contained within that policy that you are now a derivative beneficiary of, as you said. So why is it that I think you're making the argument that you're not standing in the shoes of the insured because you believe you don't need to abide by all the terms of the policy, but I don't see how that makes much sense. The only reason why you're able to bring this action is because of the policy. The policy only exists because the insured agreed to the terms of the policy.
I don't agree with that statement, Justice, and I'll explain why. The only reason I have a claim is because of the direct action statute and the fact that I got a judgment, default or otherwise. It would have been the same if I had put on a trial and got a judgment from a jury. Until that happened, I had no rights to that policy. I did not assent to it. I did not get an assignment. I did not agree to that arbitration clause. My client didn't. I did not get an assignment from the insured prior to getting a judgment where I would have taken his rights through an assignment. The only reason I'm here, the only reason I have that claim is because the legislature created it through the direct action statute.
And which brings us back to the language that we've mentioned over and over again under the terms of the policy. You know,
I would submit to you is, well, let's put it this way. If when I originally had my injury and filed my first lawsuit, if I had sued Kinzel asking for an arbitration under that policy back then as to whether or not there was coverage, they would have refused and they would have said, go get your judgment.
That's right, because of course they would have, because at that point you didn't have a judgment.
I have. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
Because at that point I have no rights to that contract. I am not a third party beneficiary.
Are you familiar with Northfield versus Mount Holly Insurance?
Yes. Yes,
I am. 2018. That also deals with the direct action statute, correct?
Yes.
I'm just quoting language from this. And it says, in that sense, a victim of an insurance act or omission may be viewed as a third party beneficiary of the insurance contract. And it goes on to talk about such clauses would appear to have been compelled by legislative mandate for nearly 100 years. I mean, so the appellate division, as of 2018, is using this concept of third party beneficiary. Am I correct?
They are saying may be viewed as a third party beneficiary. And the appellate division below cited that case. Okay. But then the appellate division below went on to say, and I agree with them, that this is not the equivalent of a third party beneficiary in the traditional common law sense. I haven't even got to my arbitration argument would be.
Before you get to that, can I just pick up on something Justice Pierre-Louis said, please, to clarify for myself?
Please.
I think what she was saying was the direct action statute exists because there are contracts of insurance covering losses. And if your loss cannot be paid for by this bankrupt entity, you can go after the insurance company for the payment of your loss. In other words, I think what she was saying, without the contract of insurance, you don't need the direct action statute. It doesn't exist. Its application doesn't exist. I think that's what she was saying. Do you disagree with that?
Without the direct action statute, I hate to make you repeat that, Justice. I'm not sure I follow. You're muted.
I think what she was saying, and I'm sure she'll correct me if I'm wrong, is that we have a direct action statute that says you have a claim, you have a judgment against a party that caused your injury or your loss. But that party or entity that caused your loss or injury is bankrupt. It's gone. You can't collect from them. So you can go after their insurance company, the company that insured them under a contract of insurance to satisfy your loss. And I think what she was saying is without that contract of insurance, without those agreements, the direct action statute doesn't exist, and if it does exist, it doesn't matter. In other words, you have a direct action under the statute because there exists a contract of insurance to pay for your loss. I think that's what she was saying. Am I wrong?
That's right, Justice Allen.
Thank you.
Okay.
But is that wrong?
No, I agree with that. The whole purpose of the statute, it was a public policy determination that if there's insurance and an injured party has no other recovery because the insured is non-existent, insolvent, then they should have the right to recover their loss or their injury from the insurer.
And I think that was her point, and that's my point.
All right. And my point in focusing on the language that says under the terms of the policy for the judgment is that was the intent of the policy, to make sure injured parties had recovered for their loss. The intent was not so that the insurance carrier, who never bothered to defend its insured, never bothered to raise the arbitration with its insured, never bothered to do anything, could suddenly sit back and say, well, now you're waiving your right to go to trial because you're coming after me, or go to court.
Isn't the carrier entitled to say, I'm only obligated to honor the policy if under the terms of the policy, the insured should be indemnified? So in order to determine whether or not they owe you the amount of the proceeds of the policy, they have to determine whether it fits within the terms of the policy. And one of those terms is it will be decided in a foreign selection clause that contains in the policy. What is wrong with that approach?
I don't agree with that. I don't agree with the last part of it, because the procedural and arbitration versus going to court has nothing to do with the question of whether or not the injured party's loss is covered by that policy. That's so simply a forum selection that the carrier decided when it put that language in there with its insured, and I wasn't involved in that decision.
Well, you weren't involved with the decision on how much coverage the insured bought either. You weren't involved in any of it. But going back to Justice Fernandez-Vinas's point, you read the terms to limit, to define only the limits of liability under the policy and whether or not there was a recoverable claim. Am I correct?
Yes.
But the form selection clause is not a term of the policy.
It is a term of the policy. It's not a term that's relevant to the recovery, whether or not my judgment is covered by the policy.
I understand. Okay.
I mean, let's get absurd. Let's say I'm in New Jersey. Let's say that binding on agreement says you have to go to arbitration in Alaska. Am I bound?
Some jurisdictional issues.
But it does have everything to do with whether there's coverage ultimately, because it says that the issue of coverage, among other issues, is going to be dealt with by arbitration. So that's I know you've said that it's, for example, defense and providing a defense is irrelevant, but it's not the arbitration clause. If your test is relevancy, the arbitration clause is relevant to this determination. I think what you're saying is it boils down to I'm entitled to the provisions that help me, and I'm not entitled to the provisions that don't help me.
No, I'm not.
I really don't see how you get that out of the statute. And it certainly is inconsistent. I know you say you're not quite a third party beneficiary, but it's certainly inconsistent with the law on the derivative nature of a third party beneficiary's rights.
I don't agree with that, Justice.
Where's the provision that doesn't help you that's included in the statutory language?
It's not a question of me picking out which provisions help me and which don't. It's the nature of my claim as granted to me by the direct action statute. I have a claim against that policy for recovery of my judgment. So the only parts of that policy, the terms of that policy that are relevant are whether or not my judgment is covered. That was the entire purpose of the statute. It wasn't...
I think we have your position on your read of the clause that we've been focused on. Is there something else you wanted to present? Because we're running late on time.
I thank you, Jeff. My only other point was the idea that, you know, we're sort of, the questions I'm getting are sort of assuming that I'm a third party beneficiary and therefore it's fair to enforce this arbitration against me. That's not what the appellate division below concluded, and I think they were correct. I don't become anything like a third party beneficiary until I go through a trial, until I get my judgment, default or otherwise, until I can show that they're bankrupt or insolvent, and then I can go to the carrier to try to get paid. That's created by statute. Right. And the arbitration law is very clear as to whether or not you can enforce an arbitration against a non-signatory who never agreed to it. The court below properly applied that law and found under these circumstances that I'm not a traditional third party who has gotten the benefit of the contract all along. I had to go through a huge fight to get it. And the only reason I have it now is because of the statute, not because the carrier has suddenly agreed that I have the benefits of this policy.
And in essence, your position then is once you reach that stage, you have greater rights than the policyholder?
No, I have the rights granted to me by the Declaratory Judgment Act, which is to collect my judgment from that policy. I'm subject to whatever terms of that policy are relevant to that question, whether or not my judgment is covered. And, you know, you don't have to take all this idea of I stand in the shoes. You know, they love to say that in this case. They've said it multiple times. They've cited what they call judgment creditor cases. You look at those cases, they're all in the context of coverage.
I think I'm saying what you're saying. You may not like the phraseology and you're welcome to correct me. But your point is that relying on the statute itself, your argument is that you have greater rights than the policyholder has with respect to your action against the insurance company. Is that a fair summary of your argument?
I wouldn't use the word greater. Judge, I wouldn't use greater. I have.
They have to go to arbitration, and you say you don't. You say you have freer range.
I just don't like the phrase greater. What I'm saying is when my rights are to recover a judgment under the policy and terms of procedural, terms of who gets to decide the coverage, which is really all that binding provision is relevant to, not what the coverage is, but who gets to make that decision. I'm not bound by those. If you call that a greater position, I'll defer to your use of that term, but I don't like it.
By greater, I'm asking about this. The policyholder couldn't proceed in any forum other than arbitration. Would you agree?
Unless the carrier waived it in some fashion, yes, I would agree.
Let's assume, based on what we know, that that's not going to happen.
Okay.
Here, you have the right to proceed in arbitration
or outside of the arbitral forum. So in that respect, you have greater rights, which you claim are accorded to you under the statute.
Yes. Yes. Now here's my last comment I'd like to make very quick. One of the cases that Kinzel cites for this idea that I stand in the shoes of the insured is a rather old case called Dransfield versus Citizen Casualty, 5NJ190. And it's got all that language in there about standing in the shoes, no better position, all the language they like to use. But there's a quote in there that, in my opinion, highlights exactly the points that I'm making. The case involved an injured party, they're injured. After the injury, the carrier got a decree from a court that the policy was void because of fraud, maybe in the application or whatever it was by the insured. Injured party gets his judgment, moves against the carrier under the direct action statute we've been discussing. Carrier says, well, wait a minute, it's void. I got it voided for fraud. You stand in his shoes, you're out of luck. This is a quote from that case. Here, the relationship between the parties has a statutory basis. The policy of the act would not be served by a rule that would make plaintiff privy to the decree, the fraud decree, and deny him the right to litigate the issue of fraud raised in bar of the direct action statute thus afforded where the assured is proof against execution. Insured lost his policy because of a fraud finding that the carrier. Injured party moves under direct action statute. He's not barred by that. Because of the direct action statute, the court says no, they get to litigate. Did he get greater rights? He got the rights that direct action statute afforded him. And to me, and that case I think was from 1950. This, at the end of the day, what these carriers want to do is, let's look at what the carrier did here. Refuses to defend, doesn't participate at all in the case. Refuses to indemnify. Plaintiff has to go through five, and this is going to happen in every case. 5 years of litigation, gets its default judgment. Not complaining, that's part of the process.
Well, why would it possibly happen in every case? It is a very, if there is no defense on the issue of coverage, that's a valid defense that ultimately either an arbitrator or a court is going to uphold, that's a very high risk procedure to refuse to defend and let everything go to a default judgment. Now, I don't understand how in the real world, you can say that every case insurers are going to let claims against their potential insureds go to default judgment. It just doesn't happen.
I'll disagree with you again. And if I can finish my point, I've been doing these kinds of construction cases for 20 plus years. If the part and bank contractors are often insolvent, gone, out of business, pick your position. Claim comes in, insured's not around to complain about it. carrier's exposure is never more than its policy limits, and it's only what's covered. They sit back, they don't defend, they don't indemnify. Plaintiff has to go through its whole case, get its judgment. Then it goes to the carrier. Then the carrier says, well, no, you have to arbitrate. We're going to go pick two arbitrators. They're not judges. These are questions of law. We don't know who they are. And you're going to have to participate in arbitration for another few months. And if you lose, you're bound by it. You don't get to go to court to appeal that decision. That is a process that is beneficial to them, not to the injured party. Justice, in the real my practice world, I'll stand by that statement 100 times. I'm not disagreeing with you.
So a blank check payable to you and your client, is that the defense you're looking for?
A blank check?
Yeah, to your client. Is that the only thing that would be acceptable to you from what I'm hearing, your arguments? Carrier can't defend and say, we denied coverage here for whatever reason. We're going to file a declaratory judgment action. We're going to proceed to arbitration. That is not satisfactory.
No, that's not the way I would put it at all. What's satisfactory to me is that a carrier defends its client, addresses the coverage issues that it has. If it wants to do it in arbitration, let it do it with its client, because that's who it agreed to do it with.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
And this may be irrelevant. Don't be afraid to tell me it's irrelevant, because I'll stop there. But generally, if you're representing a client such as your own, and you put the defendants, you attempt to serve the defendants, you attempt to find them, but you are aware of, or you do learn of through your investigation, as you did, I guess, in this case, who the carrier is. In every one of those cases, at least maybe it's changed since the 20 some years I was practicing law, but you serve the insurance company, you give them an opportunity to negotiate, to intervene, whatever, and they decline to do so. And you pursue the claim against the insured with notice, and you get a default with notice, and you have your proof hearing with notice, and the insurance company does nothing. Aren't they at risk of exposure for whatever the judgment is, notwithstanding the direct action statute? In other words, the scenario that you're describing, except in the case of an irresponsible plaintiff's lawyer who doesn't do the appropriate investigation, is going to put if they did what you're suggesting they'll do in every case, they're at much greater risk. And I pick up what Justice Patterson said, when is that ever going to happen? Because I got to tell you, things may have changed. It's been a long time, so I was practicing as a civil trial lawyer on the plaintiff side. It never happened to me. Maybe I'm just lucky. I don't know.
They were given notice of this from day one, and they did exactly what I've said they'd done. And for them, I don't see a risk to them, because they can always, regardless of the outcome of the underlying case, they have their coverage arguments. Those arguments aren't addressed in any way during the underlying suit. So they can sit back and do nothing. And at the end of the day, they still get to argue their coverage, which is what they're doing now.
Has coverage ever been determined by any court at any proceeding?
Of course.
Did you ever bring a declaratory judgment action or any other action?
All the time.
No. In these cases, was there a court action commenced based on coverage? Because I got to be honest, if they'd been on notice since day one, I can't believe you didn't get a denial of coverage and that you didn't pursue that claim as a declaratory judgment action.
There's the rub right there.
Go ahead.
We did submit the claim directly to them.
Right.
They did deny the claim.
Right.
But I can't sue. I can't pursue a declaratory judgment action until I get my judgment, which is under the declaratory judgment, the direct action statute. If I had tried to do it earlier, it would have been subject to dismissal.
So I guess what you're saying is that now you could bring a declaratory judgment action in court on the coverage question.
Right. And I could not have done so. I could not have done so until the underlying suit was resolved and I got that judgment.
And you're doing
that. I understand. But then you would have your judgment. And today, for example, you would file in Superior Court a declaratory judgment action saying decide coverage. They would defend by saying that's an arbitrable question. And the court might say, no, you're equitably estopped. You had your chance. You haven't come in and disputed any of this before. You're not waiting until the last minute and then dispute coverage. You'd have that option of doing that now, would you not?
Which is exactly what I did, which is why we're here. This is a declaratory judgment action, Justice. It started as a declaratory judgment action.
And that
they immediately moved to dismiss, saying, no, you've got to arbitrate. And I made all those arguments, Your Honor, just articulated.
Including, I don't recall an estoppel argument ever being made. I don't recall a waiver argument ever being made. I don't. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I didn't thoroughly read the record, which is possible. Were they made, those arguments?
No, waiver was not made. Okay. My arguments below were based on the direct action statute.
I'm sorry. I need to ask you to draw your argument to a close.
Those are my comments, Your Honors. I appreciate the opportunity to be heard on behalf of my client. If there are no other questions, I'll conclude my comments.
Thank you. Mr. Mahoney, brief rebuttal, and I know you have a challenge from Mr. Sawyer to take up as part of it.
I certainly do. I will be brief because I think the situation calls for it. I think that the arguments that Crystal Point has raised in this appeal are essentially about the importance of what it perceives to be the importance and the purpose of the direct action statute are ultimately moot because in all events, Crystal Point has to arbitrate its claims against its coverage claims against Kinsale in this matter. If the statute applies, then its claims are under the terms of the policy. It's exactly what the statute says. That includes the arbitration provisions, just like it includes every other provision in the policy. I'd point out that Crystal Point suggests that somehow it can extract the arbitration provisions. And I think, if I understood correctly, suggested maybe even something else in the policy that it doesn't want to apply, but offers, number one, no legal support for the proposition that we can line draw like that in a policy. And number two, no reasonable basis to figure out where, even if it were allowed to do that, what is supposed to be in and what is supposed to be out. We don't get there because that's not what the statute says. It's under the terms of the policy. And I think the purpose of that is to confine the dispute to all the terms of the policy, and that includes the arbitration provisions.
One quick question, Chief, if I may. What is your argument as to Hawk, your coverage argument?
As to Hawk, the claim was untimely reported to Kinsale. To claims made policy, as Mr. Sawyer had pointed out, that claim was reported years after the claim had been made against Hawk and the underlying action.
I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
No, I was just going to say, all that would, in our view, that all would get resolved in the arbitration proceeding. But Your Honor,
and is it fair to say that the arguments that would be made before the arbitrator, and I know that it's hard for you right now to say exactly what those would be, but those would be on the coverage issue with respect to each of the two insureds or potential insureds that are claimed to be insureds. And you would not be submitting a legal issue like the scope of the direct action statute to the arbitrator. You'd be dealing with coverage issues only.
Yes, that's correct. I think that's correct. That's what gets arbitrated here. And I think that, like I said, I think that Crystal Point really offers no basis to argue that it can cleave the contract into what it likes and what it doesn't like under the statute. I don't think it matters to answer the gauntlet that was thrown to me a couple of moments ago. I don't think it matters beyond the statute whether Crystal Point is a third party beneficiary, an incidental beneficiary, a judgment creditor, whatever legal vehicle we want to use here by which Crystal Point thinks it has standing to sue Kinsale here, whatever that is, Crystal Point has no greater rights than the insured. That's what our law says.
And just to wrap up, the arbitration that you envision would be an arbitration like obviously tens of thousands of others for an arbitrator. Obviously, what's different here is we're dealing with a judgment creditor, default judgment creditor. But as to whether or not there was coverage under these policies for these particular professionals, that's what's before the arbitrator.
Yes, and there are actually three arbitrators. They would be by default, but yes, that's correct. And if the court does not have any further questions for me, that would conclude my
report. I have one last question. Certainly. And this goes with Mr. Sawyer's challenge. Mr. Sawyer is saying it's the statute or nothing. Mr. Sawyer has said to you, Mr. Mahoney, tell me what common law claim I have that will get me to the insurance company other than the direct action statute. And how do you respond to that?
One is potentially if Crystal Point gets an assignment from the insured, that's one way to do it. Another way might be if they could come up with another legal theory by which they're a third party beneficiary of the contract under the case law or otherwise. I think it's a moot point here because even if you were a third party beneficiary, they're bound by all the restrictions of the contract as well as the benefits of the contract. So we get to the same place, which is you'd have to arbitrate that coverage claim. So there might be, no matter what the theory is, it still has to be arbitrated. Unless there are any other questions, I will conclude.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter.